is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Next guest is Bill Bullard, B-U-L-L-A-R-D, and the website is r-calf-usa. And there's a lot of things a lot of people don't know about the cow production in our country that would make a big difference and the choices that they make at the grocery store. So do we have Bill on the line? Okay, so we got to get Bill on the line. We often think that when we go to the grocery store that the choices that we make when it says grown in the USA, that means that it was produced in the USA. But if you look at the small lettering, the small letters, then you will find that maybe that food didn't really come from the USA at all, and maybe it came from Australia or some other country. Now, several years ago, I wrote an article, several articles, about, excuse me, about Colorado and a land grab in this country. I don't know why you're calling Patrick Slattery. I'm not sure. Our guest is Bill Bullard. Okay, we have him now. Okay. Poor Patrick. Okay. No, I have to tell him I wasn't. Okay, Bill, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you for being on, and thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for your website. Could you tell us exactly what you do and why you do it?
Sure. For the past 17 years, I've been the CEO of RCAF USA. It stands for the Ranchers Cattlemen Action Legal Fund, United Stock Growers of America. So our trade association represents the interests of U.S. family farmers and ranchers that raise and sell cattle. We are distinguished from our counterpart that is the largest organization called the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, and that organization purports to represent our producers, independent cattle producers, but it also represents meat packers, and our organization only represents the live cattle producers that want U.S. consumers to have the most wholesome beef product in the world, bar none, and that they're concerned about how their marketplace is shrinking because of market consolidation and concentration in the industry. So we represent family farmers that raise cattle.
Well, and that is great. And there's a lot of family farmers that are no longer raising cattle. When I was writing about the problem back in accelerated during the snows of 2005-2006, a lot of people lost, what was it, there were 10,000 head of cattle were froze to death. All of these horrid things happened. And it started out as a land grab. And now there are people who, or ranchers who need representation, who need support, and so your organization kind of helps to do that. Is that correct? And there are a lot of issues involved.
Oh, that's right. In fact, in terms of the loss of our producers, our family farmers and ranchers that raise cattle, we've lost over 500,000 of them just since 1980. So there's only about 750,000 cattle producers left in the United States. And the reasons that we lost so many are twofold. Number one, We went through a period called merger mania in our industry, where today we have four multinational meatpackers that control 85% of the market. So they act as gatekeepers and kingmakers, and they limit access to the market, which is driving many producers out of business. The other thing they do is they bring in billions of pounds of imported beef into the United States, but they do not label that product as a foreign product. Thereby, they're convincing consumers that it is a U.S. product, and U.S. consumers are willing to pay for what they believe to be is the good reputation of our U.S. family farmers and ranchers, when in fact, you know, they may well be purchasing beef that was produced in Uruguay, Brazil, Argentina, New Zealand, Australia, Nicaragua, or any one of the 18 countries we import from. So U.S. producers have been unable to compete in their own marketplace because these multinational meatpackers have convinced lawmakers that U.S. consumers don't deserve to know where their beef comes from. And that's a huge problem and has helped to reduce the number of producers in the United States of America, which hurts consumers because it reduces our food security. It puts the food production in the hands of a very small group of multinational corporations who do not necessarily have loyalties to the United States. And then, because consumers cannot distinguish which products are produced under the U.S. food safety system, they may be buying products from a country that's having a disease outbreak that simply hasn't reached the news yet.
Oh, gosh. And there are a lot of issues with importing cattle from various places. That the slaughtering standards are not the same. Perhaps they give them things to address parasite issues and other things that are very bad. So could you talk about those?
Well, absolutely. We used to have a standard in the United States because we recognized the importance of maintaining the highest possible standards for imported meat. So we used to require all foreign countries that wanted to export meat to the United States had to have a food safety system that was at least equal to that of the United States. But when we entered the World Trade Organization in 1995, the United States relaxed all its health and safety standards because it recognized that developing countries did not have the infrastructure, nor did they make the investment to be able to achieve the high standards of the United States. So in their infinite wisdom, our lawmakers lowered our standards. Since 1995, the standard has been these countries only have to have systems that are equivalent to that of the United States. Very recently, in 2015, our U.S. Department of Agriculture auditors determined that Canada had the lowest possible passing grade for its food safety system. Clearly, that's far below being at least equal to the United States. And as you talked about, we still have countries in South America that are using the banned pesticide DDT. We also have countries like Australia that it's allowed to use vaccines and antibiotics on cattle that have been prohibited in the United States. Very recently, just a couple years ago, ESPN News announced that U.S. Football players should avoid eating meat from China and Mexico because of high levels of phenbuterol that was found in the products. So the production systems, as you indicated, in foreign countries is not the same as that of the United States. In the United States, we produce the best beef in the world and under the best of conditions. But the meat packers, the Tysons, the Cargills, the JBS from Brazil, and National Beef, they want consumers to believe that beef is beef regardless of whether the animal was born and raised in Nicaragua, Manitoba, Mexico, or wherever, and it doesn't matter that beef is beef, and that simply is not true. The animal lives for 15 to 2 years of its life before it is harvested, and how that animal is raised from birth until it is harvested makes a huge difference in the quality and safety of the meat.
I think we've all seen these YouTube videos where it shows how chickens live, who are being raised for food, and how other animals, pigs, and it's pretty awful. It just makes me sick. It makes you want to go vegetarian.
Well, that's the difference between a family farm system of agriculture,
yes,
like the United States was built upon, versus a more industrialized factory farm system of agriculture that all of our industries are headed towards. And that's the trajectory that our U.S. cattle industry is on, but we're the last frontier. We're the last livestock sector that has not been completely controlled by the multinational corporations from birth to plate. They control the poultry industry to the extent that the poultry farmers are really serfs on their own land. They don't even own the chickens, nor do they even buy the feed. The company purchases the feed, delivers the feed, delivers the bird, and then tells the farmer how to raise the birds. That's not a family farm system of agriculture. That's not what America was built on. That's not what provided us the most wholesome and abundant food supply in the world. We're actually headed in the wrong direction. But as I said, the cattle industry is the last frontier. We need to take a stand here. We need to change this direction and preserve for the remaining family farmers and ranchers the opportunity to continue to be economically viable in the cattle industry without having to be controlled by the meatpackers that want to control them through what is called the vertical integration, where the meatpackers essentially own every segment of the supply chain. And it's happening to our industry, but our organization is fighting to prevent it from happening.
And that is in Colorado. And what attempts are being made to snatch land and to industrialize the farms there?
Well, what we're seeing is that in the cattle industry right now, the cattle industry is one that requires a lot of grassland, because the family farmers and ranchers have herds of mother cows. They breed those cows, and then they calve out a new calf every year. And the calf stays on the mother's side for about 6 months, and then it is raised on a growing ration until it reaches the age of about 12 months, a year to 15 months, and then it's brought into the feedlot sector of our industry. That's where the concentration first begins in the industry, and that's the segment of the industry that the meatpackers are now trying to completely capture. So they're not necessarily trying to capture the land away from the family farmers and ranches that are keeping mother cows and raising calves, but rather they're trying to capture control over the feedlot sector of our industry. Now, just 20 years ago, we had about 112,000 feedlots across the United States. Most of those were called farmer feedlots. They were small feedlots that an individual family farmer would own and maintain. It's the farmer feedlots that have been dropping like flies for the past 20 years. We've lost over 85,000 of them. 73% of all the feedlots that we had just 22 years ago are gone today, and most of those were the family-sized feedlot operations. And what is happening is the feedlots today are getting bigger and bigger, and they're becoming controlled by the meatpackers, and they are no longer even offering their cattle for sale in a competitive marketplace. Instead, the meatpackers are controlling that segment of the industry. So what's happening is when the meatpackers control the feedlot sector of our industry, they lock down competition, and they're able to dictate to everyone else in the industry the terms of production and terms of marketing, and that's how they capture the supply chain away from what used to be a very viable and vibrant family farm system of farming and ranching in the United States.
Oh, my goodness. This is terrible. Really terrible.
Well, as I said, it's the last frontier, and we're taking a stand. And we're asking consumers to stand with us because this is very much in their interest to ensure that we continue to have U.S. farmers and ranchers raising beef that consumers can choose to buy in the marketplace. Of course, they can choose to buy beef from Mexico, Canada, Uruguay, Argentina, or New Zealand if they want to. But we want them to have the choice to support the U.S. farmer and rancher, and we want them to be able to choose a meat product that was produced under the highest standards in the world. And that's right here at our feet.
So what would the consumer demand at the store? Just ask, read the label, and then ask the guy behind the counter?
That's exactly what they should do. They should ask for meat that was produced exclusively in the United States. In fact, they should ask for beef that is born, raised, and harvested right here in the United States. And that's what a bill that has just been introduced in the Colorado legislature, it does. It requires retailers, grocery stores, to put a placard by the beef to denote which beef was born, raised, and slaughtered in the United States versus which beef was either imported from a foreign country or brought into the United States as live animals from foreign countries and then slaughtered here. And so that piece of legislation is extremely important because we used to have a country of origin labeling law, but the meatpackers joined forces with Canada and Mexico to file a complaint at the World Trade Organization, and that caused Congress to repeal the country of origin labeling law. That's from May of 2013 until December of 2015, informed every consumer that bought beef at a grocery store what beef was produced in the United States versus what beef came from any one of those 18 foreign countries.
Yikes. People just don't know about this. They really don't.
No, they don't. And that's by design. It's by design, and it's why when you go to the grocery store to buy a meat product, a rib steak, or a roast, you will see a U.S. inspection sticker on it, which would, of course, lead you to believe it must be a U.S. product. Nothing could be further from the truth. That U.S. inspection sticker is put on all imported beef, and it's designed so as to not distinguish one product from another. And that's why we joined with consumer groups in 2002. We joined with the Consumers Federation of America. We worked with Consumers Union, and we worked with Food and Water Watch. We worked with those consumer groups because their consumers, their members wanted to know where the beef came from. They were buying it for their families. And we as a producer organization wanted consumers to be able to choose our beef. So we went to Washington, we passed the Country of Origin Labeling Law in 2002, and the multinational meatpackers and the meatpacking lobby came unglued. They reorganized, regrouped, they fought back, they convinced Congress, which we could call the swamp, they convinced the swamp to prevent USDA from writing the rules to implement the law that Congress passed. So the law was passed in 2002. It was partially implemented in 2009. It wasn't fully implemented until 2013, about 11 years later. I mean, this is ridiculous, but it's what happened, and it demonstrates just how powerful the food industry is. The multinational meatpackers do not want consumers to know where they are sourcing their beef, because they are sourcing their beef from countries like Nicaragua, like Uruguay and Argentina and Brazil, countries that simply do not have the infrastructure to meet identical health and safety standards that we require right here in America.
Wow. What is HACCP?
That's HACCP. That's the Hazard Analysis Critical Control Point System of meat inspection and meat safety. In other words, this was a part of a NASA design system to ensure the highest quality, highest possible quality in the systems necessary for the tray system. So the meatpacking industry adopted this cash-up system, and it was designed to help provide a blueprint and framework for establishing that food safety is meeting all the criteria necessary to be of the highest possible level. But what happened was, is HACCP was designed to be governed by the government and then implemented by the private sector. Well, the private sector has taken it over completely in the meat industry, and now the private industry is actually self-policing itself, and that isn't working. So the HACCP system has been modified to an extent where it's no longer the same kind of a system, nor is it reliable as it was when it was developed.
Oh, my goodness. All righty, we're going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Our guest the last hour today is Bill Bullard, and the website that you want to visit is r-calfusa, and we're talking about many of the issues that you can find on that website. If you click issues, you're going to find a lot of topics. And one of the ones that I was just looking at was checkoff, and talks about some of the laws that have been passed and judgments that have been passed. Your organization is doing a lot of good. It's doing it works not only in Colorado, but throughout the country, and it's terrific, and I applaud you for doing this. Without organizations like yours, well, there wouldn't be any cattle growers left, probably.
That's what we point to as our most successful factor of our organization for the past 17 years is we have not allowed the meat packers to do to the cattle producer what they have already done to the poultry and hog and sheep producers. You know, if we look at the sister industries, the hog industry, for example, just 30 years ago, we had over 665,000 hog producers scattered all across the United States. By 2012, 9 out of every 10 of those were out of business. We wiped out over 90% of all the hog producers just in the course of about half a lifetime. And when I say we, it was done through poor public policies that were dictated by the multinational meat packers that wanted to capture the whole supply chain away from competitive cattle producer or hog producers. So they've done it also in the sheep producers. We've lost over a third of all the sheep producers in the United States. And what's interesting there is we had a very vibrant sheep industry across the United States for many, many years. And in the early 1980s and 90s, the sheep industry was thriving. But by the mid-90s, about 20% of our domestic lamb and mutton production was being imported from Australia and New Zealand. And suddenly, the imports skyrocketed, and they were coming into the United States at such a cheaper price that they were driving U.S. sheep producers out of business. And in 2006, and even though domestic consumption of beef remained relatively constant, even though that was the case, we wiped out about, as I said, we only have a third of our sheep producers left. But what happened was in 2006 is the sheep industry became the first livestock sector in America to be effectively outsourced. Because since 2006, we have relied more on imports from Australia and New Zealand than our beleaguered sheep industry can currently produce. We wiped out the production capacity of that industry. And if we look at in Peoria, Illinois, at the beginning of last year, a stockyard, an auction yard that had been in business for 150 years, closed its door. And that's because that was a stockyard that sold hogs in a competitive environment. Well, no longer are hogs sold in a competitive environment. They're all contract, not all, but the vast majority are contracted to the multinational packers that control the supply chain. And so what we need to do in our cattle industry in order to preserve it is we have to reverse this ongoing elimination of the competitive marketing channels within our industry, because when they're gone, it's game over. When we no longer have our local auction yards to market our lighter weight cattle, when we no longer have our independent farmer feeders to buy our feeder cattle before they're sold to the packer, and when we only have four meat packers controlling 85% of the market, when the competition's gone, it isn't coming back. This will all be controlled by the multinational corporations. We have to prevent that from occurring, and that's why we're here and what we've been doing for 17 years. And again, our greatest accomplishment is they have not yet taken over our industry, despite the considerable, the tremendous market power and political power that those four meatpackers possess in Washington, D.C.
And those meatpackers are?
The largest is Tyson. The second largest is JBS. JBS is a Brazilian firm. The third is Cargill. The fourth is National Beef Packing Company.
Wow. All righty, we're going to a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest the last hour is Bill Bullard, B-U-L-L-A-R-D. The website that you want to visit is r-calfusa.com. And you mentioned the four meat packers. You mentioned Tyson Foods, and they're in Arkansas. And I know that during the Clinton administration, when he was actually governor, that he allowed he allowed Tyson to get away with a lot of things that really impacted the environment, the rivers, and whatnot. And we usually think of Tyson associated with chicken. But Tyson now has, 25% of the U.S. market share for beef?
Yes. And that's right. Tyson started out with chicken, and there's a book out called The Meat Racket that was authored by Christopher Leonard. He's a former Associated Press writer. And he wrote about the Tyson history and the evolution of Tyson. And he explained how Tyson took over the poultry industry and figured out a way to pay the farmers just enough to keep them producing birds. But many weren't receiving enough and would actually go out of business. But there was enough turnaround to keep the model working. Tyson then applied that model, and I referred earlier and said that it's like the farmer is a serf on his or her own land. Well, that model was then applied by Tyson in the hog industry, and that's how Tyson helped eliminate 9 out of every 10 hog producers that were in business just half a lifetime ago. Now Tyson is focused on the beef industry, to apply the very same poultry and hog models to our industry. And you're right in terms of their market share. It's about 25%. Tyson slaughters about 28,000 head of cattle a day. And so if they can manipulate the market by just a little bit, say by $1 per hundredweight on cattle, they stand to earn millions of dollars every week, because they are such huge processors within the industry. The second largest meat packer is a Brazilian-owned company called JBS. JBS came to America in 2008. They bought out Swift & Company, which used to be a pretty recognized brand name. And we went to the Justice Department and said, you need to block any further mergers from this company, because they were recently cited in Brazil for engaging in antitrust activities that was harmful to the cattle producers in Brazil. In other words, they were exploiting cattle producers unlawfully. Well, JBS actually paid a $7 million fine to their antitrust division in Brazil, and nevertheless, our Justice Department welcomed them into the United States. Then that company was terribly aggressive. It wanted to buy the fourth and fifth largest beef packers in the U.S. We went back to the Justice Department and urged them to block these mergers because this was a bad actor operated in the United States. The Justice Department's request fell on deaf ears. Then JBS came in and bought Pilgrim's Pride, the largest poultry-producing company in the United States. And then to show just how powerful and influential these companies are, last year when Kimmy Lewis in Colorado, a legislator in Colorado, introduced the Country of Origin Placard Bill, about a week before the hearing in the Colorado House Agriculture Committee, JBS made a $12.5 million contribution to Colorado State University. And that had a chilling effect on the leadership in the House Ag Committee and the state of Colorado, and Kimmy Lewis's Country of Origin Placard Bill was defeated soundly, and that demonstrated how powerful this company was. And recall, soon after that, news reports came out that JBS was bribing government officials in Brazil, over 1,800 of them. They were shipping tainted beef in the world export market. They were bribing food safety officials. And the leadership of JBS was jailed for insider trading. So here is a terribly corrupt company we welcomed into the United States. It has done untold damage to our industry by helping to repeal country of origin labeling on a national level and on the state level, prevent it from being passed. And here we are, still welcoming that company in the United States. In fact, when the rest of the world began closing their borders after learning that Brazil was cheating and sending tainted meat in the export market, many, many countries around the world closed their border. The United States kept its border open for 3 months. We urged our Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, to close the border immediately to protect U.S. consumers, and it took him 3 months to do it. And so consumer, this is the importance of country of origin labeling. If consumers knew from what country their meat came from, and if they didn't have confidence in a food safety system in Brazil, for example, suppose they heard the news report about what Brazil meat packers were doing, they could choose to avoid that product in the U.S. marketplace and buy beef from the United States of America, we would hope, or they could choose Mexico or Canada or Australia, but they could avoid the country that they didn't have confidence in. But without country of origin labeling, they do not have the tool to do that. So if they want to avoid Brazilian beef, they have to avoid all beef. And that hurts the U.S. farmer and rancher again. And so that's why country of origin labeling is so vitally important to consumers, but also to producers, because only if consumers can exercise choice in the marketplace, and of course, that's how competition occurs in an industry, is through the choices that consumers indicate in the marketplace, only then can our U.S. cattle producers compete. Otherwise, JBS can keep bringing cheaper beef and cheaper cattle from Mexico, the country I said was associated with the clenbuterol scandal. They could continue bringing that cheaper product into the United States and pass it off to unsuspecting consumers as if it were produced right here in the United States. And that is deceptive. It is wrong, and we're trying to change that. We have a lawsuit, in fact, trying to remedy that as well.
Excuse me, who was the Secretary of Agriculture that didn't...
Sonny Perdue. He's the former governor of Georgia.
Perdue, huh?
Yes.
Well, all righty.
And unfortunately, the Secretaries of Agriculture for many of the past administrations have all catered to the multinational meat packers over the interests of independent producers. In other words, they have found it, for whatever reason, more attractive to support the big money than it is to support the hardworking men and women who have been producing the safest and most abundant food supply in the world.
The lobbyists must have a lot of money to spread around.
Their lobby force, we call them the meatpacker lobby, is extremely powerful. And these multinational meatpackers have figured out how to be even more powerful by infiltrating organizations that everyone thought represented the producers. For example, the counterpart of our organization, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, used to be the National Cattlemen's Association. It used to represent producers, but in the mid-90s, it merged with the beef packers, and now the beef packers are calling the shots. But nevertheless, that organization goes to Washington and says, what's good for the packers is good for the producers, and we represent both. Nothing could be further from the truth, because producers sell livestock to the packers that buy livestock, and there's a natural antagonism between buyers and sellers, and it's a term that we call competition. And so competition doesn't occur in an organization that attempts to represent both ends of the competitive spectrum.
Right. Oh, my gosh. Okay, what about the National Beef Packing Company? They're in Kansas City, Missouri.
That is the, yeah, that's the smallest of the big four. National Beef Packing Company is the fourth largest packer in the United States, and where, for example, Tyson and JBS and Cargill are slaughtering about 25 to 28,000 head a day, National Beef Packing Company slaughters about 13,000 head. So they're not quite half as small as the big three. And they are not considered a multinational company as is Tyson or Cargill or JBS, for example, because National Beef Packing Company is pretty much, headquartered and operating right here in the United States. But it does bring in and purchase, imported livestock for certain. And so it's among the big four, but it's the smallest of the big four.
Wow. There's a link on your website, that talks about, horse slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
And how is that related to, your business?
Well, our farmers and ranchers, particularly in the western states, operate on vast areas of rangeland, and many of them still use horses. And so the question they have is, how do you dispose of, if you will, a horse that has ended its useful life, or a horse that is not suitable for the kind of work that is done on the ranches? And what we had found was, under U.S. humane livestock slaughtering standards, it was one of the most humane ways of euthanizing an animal would be to bring it to slaughter where it could be used and useful. And so when horse slaughter ended, it ended the ability of our members to humanely dispose of their horses for whatever reason. And there are horses out there that are not suitable for ranch work. But what has been happening is people who are not ranchers didn't know what to do when they needed to dispose of horses, so they would drop them off on some of our members' property, leaving them to be fed by the rancher or to starve. And if you've ever watched an animal starve because of lack of food, that is not a humane way of euthanization. So we passed a policy, our members passed a policy that said that we support horse slaughter, and we don't support what's happening now, and that is they're loading horses on trucks in America and shipping them to Canada and Mexico to be slaughtered, and they're not being slaughtered under the United States humane livestock handling requirements. And that's a concern to many ranchers. So it's a choice that ranchers have. Many of them will not sell an animal that's been, you know, a good partner on the ranching operation. They will tend to those animals and then perhaps have the veterinarian come out and euthanize them when the animal can no longer survive on its own. And so the issue of horse slaughter is a humane means of disposing of animals that are either unwanted or need to be euthanized. And without the slaughter, our options are very, very limited.
Okay. I think everybody loves horses. And that caught my eye. And I looked at the list of the legislation, and this is just really, really amazing what is being done without people knowing about it, and the property rights. Tell us about the property rights and how that impacts what is going on in Colorado and elsewhere.
Well,
tell us about the Bundy family.
Okay, so let's bring the property rights up to the Bundy family.
Okay.
In the United States, we had vast areas of land that were not inhabited. And so Congress passed the Homestead Act for all of the land east of the 100th Meridian. And, it, you know, you could get a quarter of a section of land, and all you needed to do was build a home on it and improve it. And that was a means of populating the central and eastern part of the United States. But out west, the land was arid. It was less inhabited, and the habitat was less conducive to population. And so Congress had to figure out something different. And they said, well, having a Homestead Act for a quarter section of land will not work out west. So what we need to do is modify our program, and let's provide the means for a family to have control over a economically viably sized unit out west. So we have some very large ranches that is still on land controlled by the federal government, and the federal government allows ranchers to graze that land under a grazing permit. And the producer pays for the permit, and it's not perpetual, but it pretty well stays with the producer so long as the producer keeps it up. Well, over time, the public policy had been, we want to populate the West so we can have vibrant and viable rural communities all across Western United States. In order to do that, we need larger areas of land to support families, and that was ultimately good for America. But by the end of the 1970s, there was a complete change in the policy towards populating the West. Now, rather than wanting to populate the West, the theory was we should depopulate the West and leave it to the wildlife. And so there was a complete shift in how the ranchers who had been caring for this federally controlled land, how they were being treated. And in fact, there's been many examples where they have been driven off the land. So that brings us to the Bundys, who took a stand and said, I'm not going to pay the grazing permit because I don't recognize the federal government's authority out west. What that represents is kind of the peak, the apex of a decades-long controversy over what should be done with the lands out in the West. And our position as a ranching organization wanting to support family farmers and ranchers in all areas of the United States, we think what the Bureau of Land Management and the federal government and the Forest Service has done in terms of trying to drive producers out of these Western lands, they've done it by limiting the cattle they could put on their properties or by completely eliminating the grazing at all. And what the courts have found, and this is where the Bundy brings some of his argument, but what the courts have found is as a result of the act of Congress, much like the Homestead Act, producers that made improvement actually accrued a vested property right in the grazing and the water. And that's the
point. Sure. All righty, we're going to take a 3-minute break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest this third hour today is Bill Bullard, and his website is r-calfusa.com. And you were talking about the Bundys, and I now have a different understanding of that, and so please continue.
Well, the Bundys represent the part of what's been called the Sagebrush Rebellion, and that's rebellion against the government's shift in policies from at one point trying to populate the West to where we are today, they're trying to depopulate the West. So there's two schools of thought, and Bundy represents one of them. One school of thought says when the federal government gave this land to ranchers of a size suitable to maintain an economically viable unit, they gave to the ranchers the ability to earn rights to that property. And they have done that over the years by paying the grazing fee, by using the property, by improving it. They've actually accrued vested rights in the water for their livestock and the grazing of their livestock to and from the water. And so that's viewed as a split estate. So the rancher owns the surface, the water, and the grazing, but the federal government retained the minerals and the timber on that property. So the one school says, in the West, we have a split estate, and the federal government is refusing to recognize the property rights of the ranchers on the surface. So that's one school of thought on the Sagebrush Rebellion. Bundy represents a more extreme view and says the federal government never had the right to own this property in the first place, and therefore has no authority over the ranchers out in the West. And since the Bundys went through, their conflict and went through the court system and the case was dismissed, he spent 2 years in jail trying to prove his point. But the point is we've never yet decided the point. We don't know today if that is correct, that the federal government never had authority on that property in the first place. That answer remains unaddressed. So it will be a continuing issue. We're going to continue to see conflicts, and you're going to continue to see both of these schools of thought run on parallel courses because they're not likely to merge, because those who view this to be a split estate are essentially acknowledging that the federal government does have ownership in the minerals and the timber and the underlying portions of the land. So the Sagebrush Rebellion is going to continue, unfortunately. And the ranchers out there, many of which will continue to be squeezed to the point where they may not be able to economically operate the unit anymore if they are precluded from running enough cattle in order to maintain no viability. And, of course, there's all kinds of arguments about that, where if you're not grazing the land, you're allowing fuel to continue to mount year after year. And many say that's why we're seeing these horrendous wildfires today that we didn't used to have. It's because we're no longer managing the underbrush
these
federally managed lands.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. Well, we need to have you back on. There's so many other questions I wanted to ask you. Thank you so much, Bill.
My pleasure. Thank you, Deanna.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye, listeners. Thank you for listening. Talk with you next week.